Hi, I'm Jerry Cuddy, President and CEO of Beneficial Bank. Beneficial is proud to support cultural institutions like the Free Library of Philadelphia, which contribute to the vitality of our region by advancing education and literacy and inspiring curiosity and learning in our communities.
The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Marty Gallagher, Beneficial Bank. This morning's event is part of the Free Library's Leading Voices series, which features great conversations with top minds in business. I'm proud that Beneficial Bank is the lead sponsor of this important and thoughtful series of programs that inspire us to become better leaders in the workplace and better people in our daily lives. I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, a true patriot, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. His resume precedes him with a long list of public service roles that began as a United States Air Force officer and ultimately led him to the directorship of the CIA. Secretary Gates recounted his time served under President George W. Bush and Barack Obama as Secretary of Defense in his number one New York Times bestseller entitled Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. He's been named one of Time Magazine's most influential people and one of America's best leaders by U.S. News and World Report. In his new book, A Passion for Leadership, Lessons on Change and Reform from 50 Years of Public Service, he draws upon decades of experience to map transformative solutions for some of America's largest public and private institutions. Publishers Weekly calls it a must-read for anyone who wants to be an agent of change. He'll be interviewed today by journalist Tracy Matizak. Please join me in welcoming Secretary Robert Gates to the Free Library.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being with us on this frosty January morning. Secretary Gates, welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all for being intrepid enough to show up at an early hour.
Well, congratulations on the book. The book is called A Passion for Leadership, Lessons on Change and Reform from 50 Years of Public Service. And you said on the book that you had young people in mind as you wrote it. Why is that? And what do you want to say to them through this book?
One of my concerns is that I think a lot of young people choose not to go into public service today. I saw in the military as president of Texas A&M and now as national president of the Boy Scouts, a lot of people who in their teenage years and college years and early military service years who were very idealistic, principled, and eager to serve, and they're very much engaged, particularly in college and scouts and so on, in volunteerism and in doing public service, but that all kind of gets derailed after they graduate from college. And I read in the Wall Street Journal about a year ago that 25 years ago, roughly 30% of the federal workforce was under the age of 30. And today it's 7%, so a quarter of what it was 25 years ago. And so part of the reason young people don't go into public service is that they see particularly government entities, whether it's local, state, or federal, as moving at a glacial pace, hierarchical, not very competent, and sometimes arrogant in the way that that they deal with the people they're supposed to serve. And young people they're not prepared to wait in line to make a contribution 10 years from now. They want to make a contribution right away. and other venues offer that offer them those opportunities. And so it's a circular, I mean, it's sort of a, what I hope to do is by encouraging people in both the public and private sectors to reform and change organizations and make them better, is also to create an environment in which more young people are willing to go to work for them because they can be proud to work there, because these places work, they're cost efficient, they're friendly to the people that they serve, and they do what they're supposed to do.
Why is it so difficult to bring about reform, particularly for large institutions like the ones that you talk about in the book?
Well, I think there are several reasons. One is, particularly in the public sector, most organizations are subject to oversight by elected officials. And often elected officials' agenda is more personal than it is in terms of what's good for the city, the state, or the country.
I'm sure we have no idea what you're talking about.
And also, change often involves risk. It can involve, people putting out stories that are negative about the change that is being contemplated. So for a politician, there's a lot of downside to change and a lot of risk associated with reform if you really want to get it done. A lot of them talk about reform, but it's mainly just talk. Another problem is that there are a lot of stakeholders involved. So you may have, whether it's business interests or lobbyists or a variety of other people, who want things to stay just the way they are, that don't want change, don't want reform. And then it's just hard. You have a lot of people who, the people who work for you, if you're a reform leader, people who were there before you got there and will be there after you leave, and if they don't want to change and if they don't like, if they're not on board, they can just outwait you. And so there are a number of these and a number of other considerations that make leading reform a challenge, and really the heart of the book is about how you get past all that. How do you get the people who are the career professionals to be a part of your team? How do you get them on board with your agenda? My view is, and I say in the book, that I think Americans at every level of government have the most honest and capable public servants of any country in the world. So, and I believe that nearly all of them want to be proud of where they work. So the question is, how do you earn the respect of those career professionals and make them your allies in pressing for change so that when you're gone, they become defenders of the reform process? So there are some very big obstacles. And to tell you the truth, this applies to a lot of places in the public sector, in the private sector as well. So I've tried to go out of my way in the book to make it clear that it applies not just to government, but to business, nonprofits, really to any organization. The fact is, all organizations, as the longer they're around, the more barnacles they accumulate. And if you want to make your organization better, then it seems to me that these are some guidelines. As I say in the book, I've led CIA and the intelligence community, Texas A&M, the Defense Department, and now the Boy Scouts, and I've loved every one of those organizations, but I've also believed from the very beginning that all of them could be improved. And that's basically what I've tried to do.
So reform delayed can lead to crisis. And you cite several examples early in your book about some pretty spectacular bureaucratic failures, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, scandals in the Secret Service, in the Veterans Administration. We've been watching the news this week and seeing what's happening in Flint, Michigan. we've got all this brain power, all this technology, all of this training, both in the public and the private sector, and yet we still have these failures. How is it that we're still seeing these kinds of problems?
Well, I think it's because there really has not been a serious effort to tackle reform in any of these organizations, and it unfortunately takes a crisis to get people's attention and call attention to the fact these organizations aren't working as well as they should. I mean, and if you want to, and my examples in the private sector are, I mean, I don't think that the CEOs of General Motors and Chrysler intended to drive those companies off a cliff, but they did. And so what decisions, what process did they have that ended up being so, that ended them up in such a bad place? How did some of the private sector people involved in the financial collapse in 2008, they didn't intend to crash their Bear Stearns or some of these other institutions. So the question is, how do leaders fail to see that their organization is not headed in the right direction, that the decisions that they're making are not the right decisions, and then the list in the public sector is kind of endless. Actually, I mean, to start with, 9/11 itself represented a catastrophic failure of intelligence and law enforcement. So, I think partly what I talk about in the book is partly it's due to leaders being insular and egotistical. And too many leaders not having people around them who are willing to disagree with them. Too many leaders are like Samuel Goldwyn, one of the founders of MGM, who I quote in the book, who said to his staff, "I want all of you to tell me exactly what you think, even if it costs you your job." And a lot of leaders say they want candor, but they really don't. And so how do you create an environment around you where you have people coming in and saying, you know, that may not be the best decision? I always told people, whether it was at CIA or the Defense Department, I said, I want to be warned about a landmine before I step on it. And that's your job, is to warn me if I'm about to make a mistake. And if you think I've made a mistake, to tell me so afterward, so I can at least revisit it, maybe change my mind, or maybe I'll adjust my plan. That doesn't mean you have to do what your people tell you all the time. That's ridiculous. But it does mean being aware of the downsides of the decisions that you're trying to make and potential consequences, so you can weigh all of the factors without sort of blindly pressing ahead on one path in the belief that there is no alternative or that that there are no weaknesses or problems. So it's the insularity and the isolation of the people who lead organizations. It's the failure to hold people accountable. When I fired the, you know, there are people in Washington who lose their jobs all the time because of personal misbehavior. But when I fired the Secretary of the Army because of the way we were treating our outpatient wounded warriors at Walter Reed Army Hospital, the thing that astonished Washington was that I actually fired somebody for not doing his job well enough, for not being competent. And I fired others. I fired the program director for the F-35 program and others as well. So accountability is a piece of it, and knowing people knowing they'll be held accountable. So I think leaders head off in the wrong direction too often because of their own personalities, their own conceit, their own ego, and the failure to create an environment in which they surround themselves with people they think are smarter than they are, and who they can turn to and count on for candid advice.
So many would argue that we are facing a crisis of leadership in our nation at this moment. You don't have to look a lot further than the presidential election to see that. Several questions on that. First of all, President Obama, how would you rate him as a leader at this point in his presidency?
Well, on the positive side, much to my surprise, he was a very strong decision maker. For a guy who had never run anything, he readily embraced making decisions. And if he had time, he liked to deliberate and make sure he understood all the aspects of a problem. As he once told me, he said, if I don't understand it, I can't defend it. But at the same time, if he were required to make a quick decision, as is sometimes the case, particularly on national security, he could do that. And I think a perfect example of his courageous decision-making was the bin Laden raid. But there are two aspects of his leadership that I think have been on the negative side. The first is he will announce or make a speech about a very important topic, and it'll be far-reaching and even visionary, and then there's no strategy and no implementation. And a good example of this was the speech he made in Cairo in early 2009 about the U.S. and the Middle East, which really was a great speech. And it led to a lot of excitement in the Middle East and in the Arab world that here's a president who kind of understands. But there was no there. There was nothing after the speech, no policies, no strategy, no new initiatives. And so 2 months later, great enthusiasm had turned into considerable bitterness that it had just rung hollow. The second aspect, and I think another example of the failure to implement, was obviously the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare website, which was a total disaster. And I think it ties in with the second problem that I'm going to mention, and that is micromanagement. By centralizing control of everything in the White House, first of all, there aren't enough people there to do it right and who have the right skill sets to implement things. And second, the White House is a terrible place to try and have operational control of anything. So most of the presidents that I worked under, the National Security Council staff, had 50 or 60 people. This administration's White House, NSC, has 450 people on the staff. And when you have that many, they have to go looking for things to do to justify their job. And the result is you get too much involved, you get the White House too much involved in day-to-day operational management. And one of the central themes of the book is that any leader has to pick good subordinates who share the leader's objectives and agenda, empower those subordinates, hold them accountable, but don't micromanage them. And, you know, I've complained about micromanagement, but in all honesty, I was able to hold it at bay because I was very aggressive about that. And I told the commanders, for example, I said, if you get a call from a White House staffer or an NSC staffer, you tell them you're not authorized to talk to them, refer them to me, and tell them furthermore that I told them to go to hell. I saw a direct line at a command post in Afghanistan. I saw a direct line to a White House staffer. And as I stood there, I told the commander, you tear that line out while I'm standing here watching you. You are never to have to talk to the White House staff. That's not the chain of command. So the problem that I think, and I think, frankly, that because they centralized the operational aspects of implementation of that Obamacare website in the White House, contributed mightily to the failures that they had. That's why the cabinet departments of the government exist. And if you don't have a strong enough secretary to get the job done, fire him and replace him with somebody who can. So those are the two of the leadership problems that I think beset this White House.
Well, one of the areas that people talk about quite often is our leadership on the foreign stage, particularly as it relates to terrorism and containing ISIS specifically. How are we doing in that regard as it relates to our leadership there?
Well, I think we're slowly getting to the right place. I think the military, many months ago, was telling the president that he had to have more special operators on the ground, more trainers with the Sunni tribes, with the Kurds, with the Iraqi security services, and present with them to do the training and advising, providing them more weapons, a more intensive air campaign, and things like that, and a safe haven, and forward spotters and controllers and so on. He has gradually done all that, but so gradually I think it's dissipated some of the effect. But those are the kinds of things that over the long term I think are what is necessary to, first of all, contain ISIS and then slowly strangle it. And frankly, I said at the Council on Foreign Relations yesterday that in New York, that the statements that are being made, at least by the two leading Republican contenders now, are, in terms of how you deal with ISIS, are either completely uninformed or completely cynical and opportunistic. And my worry is, I'd rather have it be the latter than the former. I'd rather that they're being cynical and opportunistic than to accept the fact they don't know what the hell they're talking about. And I think leaders, one of the things that I talk about in the book, leaders have to be transparent, and they have to be honest with the people they deal with. They have to have integrity. Because the only way that you get people to lead, to follow you, especially if you need them to do something hard, is for them to trust you. They may not even agree with you, but if they trust you, then you begin to have moral authority and people will follow you. And I'm worried that, you know, I've been around a long time. I know how political campaigns work, and this is true on both sides of the aisle. But at a time when we face so many problems, both domestically and internationally, to pretend to the American people that the solutions are simple and pain-free, I think is just plain dishonest.
Well, and you are referring, I would imagine, to remarks about carpet bombing. We're going to bomb the you-know-what out of them, those kinds of remarks from some of the candidates.
And there are some statements being made about domestic affairs on the Democratic side that are equally misleading. Mm. In terms of these grandiose proposals that any rational human being knows cannot be implemented.
Yeah. Speaking of the presidential candidates, as you look at the field on both sides of the aisle, who best embodies the principles that you put forth in your book in terms of leadership?
Well, on Morning Joe the other morning, I said I didn't see any. And I've decided that was probably overly harsh. So I'm willing to concede there may be two or three, but I'm not going to name any names.
So we'll just have to wait on that one. As you look at the Republican field, are you concerned about the future of the party as we look at, you know, Trump being in the lead, some of the confusion that's taking place within the party right now, and on the Democratic side for that matter as well, but your thoughts about the future of the Republican Party?
Well, I think what we have seen, sadly, and I would say over the past 25 years, is both parties being pulled to the extremes. To the point where in the Congress, you can't even get regular order of business done. You can't even get an appropriations bill passed. In the last 10 years, the Defense Department has started the fiscal year with an enacted appropriations bill twice, and that was 9 and 10 years ago, not in the last 8 years. So every year has begun, the last 8 years has begun with a continuing resolution or sequestration or both, building huge uncertainty into the process. If you can't pass ordinary appropriations bills, how in the world are you going to tackle some of the big problems that everybody acknowledges that we have? And when I first went to Washington, you know, we've always had polarized politics and rough politics in this country. I like to joke, at least the vice president, former vice president, hasn't shot the former Secretary of the Treasury yet. Yet. As with Burr and Hamilton, but the people, when I first went to Washington, you had a lot of people in the Democratic and Republican parties that were sort of center-left, center-right, and they were the people that I called the bridge builders, the people who would reach across the aisle and figure out a way to come up with a majority to accomplish regular business. And the names are easier for me to come up with in the Senate than in the House, but you know, people like Sam Nunn and David Boren and Jack Danforth and Bill Cohen and Nancy Kassenbaum and Jack Danforth. There were a lot of people who would work with the other side. And those people are an endangered species today. And most of them, they didn't quit because they were afraid of being defeated, and they weren't defeated. They quit because they were frustrated. I remember in 1994, David Boren was two-term senator. David could have been elected to the Senate from Oklahoma forever. And he was offered the presidency of Oklahoma University. And he called me and we talked for a while. He wanted advice. And we batted it back and forth for about an hour. And I finally said, well, David, it's easy. When you're daydreaming, when you're in the car on an airplane and daydreaming, are you daydreaming about what you can accomplish in the United States Senate or at the University of Oklahoma? And he laughed and he said, you're right, that does make it easy. And he took the job at the University of Oklahoma. And so many of the people that I respected in both parties have essentially made that decision. Bill Bradley, I don't think I mentioned Bill Bradley's name. He's another one of that group. So I think that this polarization of the parties has resulted in fewer and fewer people being center right and center left, and they're more hard left and hard right. And that's what's making it very difficult to get anything done. Partly it's structural, through gerrymandering. I mean, all but about 40 seats in the House are now safe for either Republicans or Democrats. So essentially, the only election that matters is in February, when you have to appeal to the hardcore base of your party to get your party's nomination. That's true in both parties. So that's one of the many factors that has gotten us to where we are. And it will take quite a while, I think, to change that. I would end on a slightly optimistic note in this respect. I think that the president sets the tone. And the truth is, both President Bush and President Obama have been very polarizing in their own way. And neither of them has been willing to invest the time or the energy required to try and cultivate positive relationships with members of Congress. So a president coming in committed to toning down the partisanship, to repeatedly pressing the point of the need for national unity and that we're all in this together, that our destiny is tied up with each other, and reaching out to members of Congress, even ones that he or she doesn't even like, I think could begin to at least ameliorate some of these problems.
I want to shift gears and talk about some of the nuts and bolts in your book, some of the principles for leaders. And you talk about the importance of coalition building as a skill that leaders really need to have. Certainly it was a skill that you employed very successfully, particularly at Texas A&M. What are some of the most effective ways to do that, especially if a leader is facing entrenched opposition?
Well, the first, there are a number of things that I talk about in the book, but one thing that leaders need to do as they're, so the premise of the book is you've just been appointed or chosen as the leader of an organization, doesn't matter how big it is, and you've been told it's underperforming or it's broken, you fix it. It's your first day on the job. What do you do? So I think the first thing is to figure out what's wrong. How do you diagnose the problem? Well, one of the ways that you can help diagnose the problem and begin to build a spirit of teamwork is to ask the people on the front lines of the organization. I had a lunch or breakfast with junior enlisted or with junior officers on every visit I made to Iraq and Afghanistan. I'd say, how's it going? How's the equipment? How's this? How's that? And you'd be surprised how many times I learned about a problem from some staff sergeant or some captain that I would never have heard about from a general, and that the general often didn't even know about. And it's the same way in retail. You know, often the people who are dealing with the public, or if you're working in the DMV and given driver's licenses or whatever, the people who deal directly with the public often have a pretty good idea of what's wrong, why things don't work very well. And so talking to people at all levels of your organization, as I put it in the book, listening, will help you formulate the agenda for change. And because you will have gotten many of the items on that agenda from the people who are actually in the organization, they will say, holy cow, he actually listened to me. He really took aboard what I was saying, so I will try and help. I may not agree with his solution, but I'm going to try and help. And so putting the agenda together requires a collaborative effort. And you have to take what you hear from people at all levels, and I think other stakeholders, you know, if it's a business, the board of directors, some shareholders, if you're in a university, the faculty, alumni, and so on. And integrating that with your own instincts and your own judgment and putting together the agenda, you've already made a step forward because you've got people on side because they were involved in the process. The key is keeping them involved in the process as you move to developing a strategy and developing the implementation techniques and continuing to listen. Another aspect of it, it seems to me, is as you move into the actual implementation, is figuring out a way to, most organizations communicate reasonably well up and down the chain of command. Some don't, but most do. But very few communicate very well laterally between different parts of an organization. And so the key is figuring out techniques on how you get cooperation across the different parts of the organization. And the truth is, sometimes somebody over in this part of the organization may actually have a great idea on how to fix another part of the organization, but they've never been asked. So I think transparency is critical in all of this. So these are just some of the techniques that, as you begin to change things, you get people on side, and there are a lot of measures that you can take that communicate respect for the career professionals. And the sort of one of the core pieces of advice in the book is no matter whether you're in the private or the public sector, showing respect for the people that work in the organization is critical, and they will notice. And my argument is you can be the toughest, most demanding boss on the planet and still treat people with respect and dignity.
What about the importance of a leader having the ability to anticipate trends, anticipate changes? You talk about Gates 2.0 in the book, and talk about the importance of that for leaders.
Well, for me, I mean, the two big things that I did in that respect was when I became director of Central Intelligence, overseeing all the intelligence agencies, that was 6 weeks before the Soviet Union collapsed. So my agenda was, the thing I said, you know, looking ahead, we have to move this monolithic monster from focusing on the Cold War and the Soviet Union to a much more multipolar world with many more challenges than we have faced and when we could just focus on the Soviet Union. So how do you move these agencies and move money? How do you create the different kinds of skill sets to deal with a different set of problems? And I'll just give you one example. In the spy business, most of the ways that we would meet potential Soviet or East European spies was on the diplomatic circuit. So most of our CIA case officers had diplomatic cover and worked out of our embassies. Well, as we moved away from the Cold War, the kinds of challenges we were going to face, as I put it in my first book, the sources that we would need, the spies we would need to deal with drugs and terrorism and organized crime and so on, are not people you meet on the diplomatic cocktail circuit. So we were going to need a different kind of spy to go after those kinds of targets. So seeing that we were going to have we would have to change for the future was critically important. In the Defense Department, what I tried to do was to, based on the past, was to say, you know, we've got to be prepared to deal with big conventional states as a potential conflict, in a potential conflict. But based on every conflict we've been involved in since Vietnam, we are going to face an unpredictable, incredibly broad array of challenges. And so we have to train and equip our forces to give them the maximum possible flexibility across the broadest possible spectrum of conflict and lethality. So you have to be able to handle the Chinese naval threat in the South China Sea, but you also have to have a special operator that can go into Mali and help deal with the terrorism problem. And that's a different mindset than we had before Iraq. The mindset in the Army before Iraq was we have a big conventional army, and because we can take on the Soviet Union at the full de gap, that same army can meet all the requirements of every lesser conflict. And it became quite clear that's not true. So this is a matter both of recognizing reality, but also trying to anticipate the kinds of challenges that you'll face in the future. Now, the truth is, the more specific you get, the more like, in terms of trying to predict the future, the more likely you are to be wrong. And to tell you, I'll be honest with you, CIA is no better at predicting the future than anybody in this room. And where they've usually gone wrong is when they've tried to do that. But if you're looking at broad strokes, sort of the big picture, then the chances of getting it right are probably pretty good. And I'll give you an example. I'm on the Starbucks board, and who would have thought that a coffee company would pioneer in mobile order and pay? And it was this vision that the world is moving into a digital arena that Howard Schultz anticipated that, and Starbucks is out in front. Another example, I was chairman of the independent trustees of Fidelity Funds before I became secretary. And in the early 90s, Ned Johnson invested $1 billion in building the back office capability for 401ks. And to this day, Fidelity dominates that market. He had the vision to see that this retirement business was going to be good. And furthermore, from a business standpoint, the great thing about 401ks, no matter what the stock market is doing, those automatic deductions from your paycheck keep flowing in.
On that note, we will open it up for your questions and comments for the secretary. So if you've got a question, just raise your hand. We'll get to as many of you as possible. Yes, ma'am, right here. There's a microphone on the way.
Hello. Thank you for coming. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the agreement with Iran and your thoughts about the success for it and where it might be going. It's good points where there may be problems and so on.
Well, I think you've put your finger on it. There are some things about that agreement that are good. Let me preface it by saying I started working as an intelligence officer on arms control negotiations with the Soviet Union in 1970. So I've done nuclear arms control for a very long time. The agreements that we signed with the Soviet Union were all about constraining nuclear weapons. None of them ever had anything to do with constraining Soviet behavior elsewhere in the world. That was separate. And the way I describe it is, you have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time to negotiate where it's in your interest to do so on limiting nuclear weapons, and then separately have an aggressive policy to deal with the other behavior of your adversary. So I think good points of the agreement, anything that gets 98% of the enriched uranium out of Iran is a good deal. Getting 2/3 of their centrifuges dismantled is a good deal. Getting that reactor at Iraq modified so it can't produce plutonium is a good deal. What are the problems? The administration, as late as April, was telling us they had to have any time, any place inspections. They abandoned that. The administration consistently said they had to have a history of the Iranian effort to weaponize to make nuclear weapons, their research program, and they gave up on that. So I think that the verification aspects of the agreement are seriously flawed. My problem with the agreement is less with the agreement than with the assumptions that underpin it. And that is that if you strike this agreement and lift the sanctions, that over time, over the 10-year period of the agreement, that the Iranians will evolve into a normal nation state, abandon their theological revolutionary ideology, abandon their aspirations in the region, and abandon their interest in nuclear weapons. And I think all that's very likely to be wrong. And so what I think the president should have done is, in parallel and coincidentally with the nuclear agreement, is announce a robust strategy for how we were going to contain Iranian meddling in the region that would be partly funded by the increased resources they would get from lifting of the sanctions. So what increased military presence would we have? What increased aid would we give to our friends and allies? How are we going to work diplomatically and in the intelligence arena to push back on Iran's very aggressive behavior? The irony is the Ayatollah gave that speech on what Iran was going to do when they signed the agreement. And I think one of the reasons for the concerns on the part of our allies is that there was no comparable speech coming from the United States on this second aspect of the relationship. Yeah, you know, if it all evolves happily, that'd be great, but I sure wouldn't bet on it. But I think the agreement is better than no agreement. And if it buys us 10 years, that's a good thing. And then we'll have to deal with it then. But where we could have confronted an Iranian nuclear weapon perhaps within 6 months to a year.
Given your focus on leadership, could you identify four or five individuals under the age of 50 across the nation that you think we should be watching for real leadership capability going forward?
Well, it's hard for me to come up with specific names, but I will tell you that I think, particularly in the arena of government, I think that there are some governors, both Democrats and Republicans, who are doing some very interesting things in terms of trying to address some big problems within their states. And they're often working with legislatures that are not of their party, or where one house is not of their party. And, you know, it's as I say in the book, as opposed to the national level, you know, at the state level and at the local level, you really have to perform. You know, if you're a mayor, if you can't get the snow shoveled or plowed, or you can't get the trash picked up, or you have a water problem, it doesn't matter what your ideology is, you're toast. And in some ways, that the governors are helped by the fact that most states have a balanced budget amendment, so they have to figure out a way to balance the budget, and that forces action on the part of these. So I think in the political arena, some of the most interesting things are happening at the mayoral and at the gubernatorial level in the country, and I'm just not current enough on some of the specifics to be able to give you some names. I wish I could tell you that I could identify some people like that in the Congress. My experience with the Congress, I testified, I used to tell, when I talk to college audiences, sometimes they're a little reluctant to start asking questions. And so when the Q&A starts, I say, now, before we start, let me just tell you this. I testified in front of Congress for more than 30 years. There is no question that you can ask me that is dumber than some of the ones I got from them. So I think actually it's easier to find some of those leaders that you're talking about under 50 in the private sector, and particularly in the tech sector, than it is to find them in the public sector.
All right, on the side, who do we have? Yes, ma'am.
Speaking of dumb questions, I do have to share one anecdote. So when I'm director of CIA, I get called by a senator who wants to meet me in the vaulted area of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he wants to talk to me privately. No staff, no security, nothing. Just mano a mano. And so we get in there, we exchange some pleasantries, and finally he looks at me and he says, tell me about the aliens. And I said, well, CIA doesn't do the immigration problem. And he said, no, the aliens. I said, oh, you mean the aliens. And I courageously responded, the Air Force handles that.
Yes, ma'am.
I certainly hope I don't ask that dumb question. Thank you, Mr. Gates, for sharing your wisdom on leadership. We certainly need it. I wondered if you could talk about your experience as a Boy Scout and how you are promoting leadership now as the president of the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, I think that, I begin the very last chapter of the book saying that my first leadership job was as a patrol leader in Troop 522 in Wichita, Kansas, and nothing teaches leadership skills like trying to get a bunch of 12 and 13-year-olds to do what they don't want to do. You can't make them do it, and you're only a year older than they are. And then I had my first formal leadership training at the National Junior Leader Training Program at Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico when I was 15. And that was the last formal training in management or leadership that I ever had. Although I have to say, as I say in the book, although I've been learning for the last 55 years. So I think it really, scouting really did start me off with some leadership skills that at least formed a base. I think the biggest change that I have contributed to in my time as president of the Boy Scouts was persuading the movement to change the standards on adult leaders in terms of sexual orientation. 70%, to give you a sense of the challenge, 70% of the scout units in America are sponsored by churches. And the Catholic Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, and the Baptists are among the biggest sponsors. So figuring out a way to move forward on this in a way that kept those churches inside the movement, at least for the future, foreseeable future, was very important. And I think we devised a way to do that. I will tell you that it has had a remarkable impact. A number of big corporations have moved back into a supportive, openly supportive position with respect to the Boy Scouts, including companies like the Disney and Coca-Cola and Home Depot and others. We have had schools open for recruitment of kids to Cub Scouts, where we've been excluded for many years, I would say including the Berkeley School District. And the result is we may be seeing, it's all preliminary right now, but we may be seeing growth in the membership in the scouting movement for the first time in nearly 40 years. So, you know, my hope is that that this effort will continue. I think that there were a lot of millennial parents who were just uncomfortable with our policies. And I think we've arrived at a balance point where the churches feel comfortable that they have their First Amendment rights to appoint leaders that whose views comport with those of the church. And so some churches will welcome gay leaders and others won't. But that's their First Amendment choice. But for everybody else, we are welcoming to everybody.
We've got time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming. I really appreciate the information that you've given us. Earlier in your remarks, you talked about the politicians, and we know all politicians, but some in the business community. One of the frustrating things is when you talk about the bureaucrats, the regulators who write regulations, there just seems to be no communication with us in the business world. And these regulations are literally driving us crazy. They change constantly. So it's very hard to create some kind of picture as to what to do in the future. How do we as citizens control these regulators that are just seem to be going crazy because they have their own political persuasions themselves?
Yeah, there was a poll taken of the CEOs at Davos this week, and the biggest of the biggest challenges to economic growth that they saw, and the number one concern, and I think it was like 83% of the CEOs said it was a changing regulatory environment, and not just in the United States but globally. And I think it goes back to the leadership of those organizations. And one of the things I talk about in the book, I specifically refer to regulatory bodies. And those who lead regulatory bodies, I think, have to have an open channel of communication with those they are regulating. And there needs to be a way everybody, when it comes to the regulatory world, everybody's over, in my opinion, is over-lawyered. And the if there were a way in which there could be a regular, informal dialogue between the regulators and particularly, you know, not necessarily those who write the regulations, but those who are their supervisors, the people who run the regulatory agencies. It seems to me that opening that dialogue and identifying specific problems. I mean, one of the things when I was making changes where it was helpful to have people on the front lines in the conversation was because when I would make a decision, I would offer it to those people in the intelligence community and the military and to the faculty at A&M, and I'd say, you're the ones that are going to have to execute this, or you're the ones that are going to be most affected by it. Is there a way to do this that will work better than the way I've put it? And if you could have that kind of a dialogue with the leadership of the regulatory agencies, where they weren't afraid to have that conversation, and your lawyers weren't constraining you from what you could say or in meeting with them, it seems to me that that would at least be a step forward. The whole thing begins with politics, and for example, at the federal level, it's the tone set by the president. So if the president says to the heads of the regulatory agencies, who are independent, but he still appoints them, so, I mean, if he could say to a prospective appointee, I want you to, you know, you have to regulate, that's your job, whether you're at the FDA or wherever you are, but I want you to have an open line of communication with those you are regulating to make sure you're not over-regulating them and to make sure that we're actually trying to accomplish the objectives that we set for ourselves and not create a lot of collateral damage because we don't fully understand the ramifications of some of the things we're doing. I think this transparency and communication is the only way to begin to mitigate the very real consequences that you're talking about. But again, it has to be set. That has to start with the tone at the top, either on the part of the president for federal agencies or by governors at the state level.
Well, Mr. Secretary, we've talked about leadership, presidential politics, foreign policy. Toughest question for last. NFL playoffs this weekend. Denver or New England? Arizona or Carolina? Who are you playing?
Since my Seahawks didn't show up for the first half of the game last week, frankly, I don't care.
Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Secretary Gates. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. The book is A Passion for Leadership, Lessons on Change and Reform from 50 Years of Public Service. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.